Today we're talking about web app compat and modernization for nerds. And to kind of level set how we're going to talk about that here, the for nerds part in essence means there will be no PowerPoints used. No PowerPoints were harmed in the making of this presentation. This is all about how do we take the process end to end, use the tools, understand the browser in order to help drive the world forward to a better, happier, more modern place. To set some context, we're going to be talking about primarily the features that you can use in an enterprise environment. How can you help to push that environment forward? In the consumer space, things are a lot better today. In fact, the consumer space went so fast, that's relatively straightforward for that. But in the enterprise space, we're still struggling. So what we want to make sure is that everyone understands all of the tools that we've been bringing to bear, and they've been coming fast and furious, to help you drive the web ecosystem forward. And we're going to talk about it, kind of taking a little tour through various things, but when we talk about where we came from, this was the concern that we had a few years ago. IE6 was everywhere and was keeping everyone on Windows XP. And kind of no one wants to be on Windows XP, and we've mostly gotten rid of it. We've got this sort of unusual little hotspot here in China where we still have over 1% market penetration. That's actually way better than it was just a couple of years ago where it was more than a quarter penetration of IE6 in mainland China. Which is a little bit, well, fortunately, there's not too many people that live in China, so that's kind of okay, but that's the objective we've gone against. And we said, all right, so we got rid of 6, and we made the decision in August of last year that we were going to end support for older versions of Internet Explorer on whatever version of the OS you're on. Is there anyone that didn't know that? Is there anyone going like, what, huh? So the word got out. So pretty good. What was going on in that decision? What were we thinking? And the idea is this. When we looked at the ecosystem and what was happening and what companies were able to choose from, we saw problems. And the one really significant problem was, hey, I'm going to go ahead and pick this browser as my corporate standard. I'm going to use it everywhere. That's great. The problem was, we weren't just giving that choice to the company, to the individual. We were also giving that choice to every single software vendor out there. And they were all making different choices. And to this date, there's not been a single customer that we've talked to that could say, I could pick this version of IE and all of my vendors would support it. Every single one would say, oh, well, I've got this vendor that wants IE 8 on my Win 7 devices, but this vendor wants only N or N-1. That's kind of evolved into a de facto standard. And I can't pick one. How do I get both? That's the question we keep getting. And so what we want to try to do is to defragment the ecosystem and increase the likelihood that you could make a choice and people would line in behind it. And that's what we hope happens. We have no, you know, delusions that that's going to be perfect. For example, Oracle did exactly the same thing. The only version of Java that's supported is the latest, period. And of course, are there any apps out there that depend on older versions of Java runtimes? Most is the response I heard. Yeah, it got better though, right? And at least people have a grounds to stand behind. So that's what we're hoping to achieve. So let's talk about the process and the flow and why we think that's not the world's most terrible thing in terms of the technical ramifications of that. When we look at what's happening in the browser space, this is actually the 1994 Microsoft website, which helpfully offers, you know, in case, you know what, if you have a browser that doesn't support images, we can do the whole thing in text. Boy, we've come a little ways since then. Oh, by the way, do you guys like this little walk-in slide? This is all HTML5. I actually had to figure out how to do the blink tag, which is no longer supported in HTML5, using CSS3 to simulate that. But I felt that kind of gave the sense of where we came from, what the web used to look like. And this is what it looked like for us. And the remarkable thing is that we can keep this thing working. through this day. This is made in 1994. This is running on, how many people are still running this? NT Server 3.5. That's what it was running off of. So, you know, we have had historically the ability to keep applications working. So I want to go a little bit into depth behind exactly what those mechanisms are. And really, the core building block of what makes web applications compatible over time is a concept that we call the document mode. So the document mode is a way for a web page to behave. It sets the rules. How am I going to lay out a page? What JavaScripts are legal? What JavaScripts are illegal? So I can behave like old ones. Now, we've been doing this for a really long time. If you look all the way back into IE6, IE6 made a significant breaking change that threatened to break the web. It was one of those events. That change was to the box model. So let's kind of briefly explain what that is. I'm going to go ahead, and I'm using the F12 developer tools, which are built in. There's no separate install. You just go and grab them. And I'm going to grab this element. I'm going to take a look at it, and I'm going to look at the layout tab. I'm going to zoom in on that. And kind of talk about what the box model is and what the impact was and why we originally made the choice to introduce doc models. Way back in the land of yore, IE5 and earlier, Netscape 4 and earlier, when you looked at how do you measure, how do you lay out a web page, we had a box model, and the box model would say, you know what? If I'm going to ask for example, the width of this element, I'm going to give you the width of this element plus the padding of the element. Which, if you think about it, makes some degree of intuitive sense, right? I have an object, and it's got some padding. Say the object is me. I have some variable amount of padding, depend upon how much I've been eating lately. But if I'm going to build a door, and I want the door to fit me, it should fit me and my padding, so I'm going to include that. But as the standards bodies became more powerful, right, and let's not be revisionist here, standards bodies did not used to be powerful, or even be able to drive consensus among them. But as they started to really form and the world kind of gathered behind, you know what? It should work on any browser, which most vendors have believed for a long time and have been striving towards. They decided that the width of an element will not include the padding, will only include this middle part, and that's it. And that was a breaking change, because suddenly things that had padding were going to lay out incorrectly. And you would end up with really weird side effects. Here is an example of a web page that was designed for quirks, designed for the old box model, relayed out without that box model. All of a sudden, you've got elements that you can't even see. They're like hiding behind stuff. It has become nearly incomprehensible. So we said, you know what? We can't just go and break everything. No one wins in that scenario. So instead, we'll let you behave the old way. And we'll do it by default. So at the time, we called it standards and quirks. We said, you know what? If you're going to be using this new method, you can have standards mode. The old one we'll call quirks because it's quirky. It doesn't have all the standards built in, and you can therefore do both. We would make it so that quirks would be the default, and the developer would opt in by putting in a doc type element into their code and saying, yep, I know all about new standards. Please go ahead and give them to me. I'm ready for them, to make it opt-in. Work by default, opt-in to the new. Now, there's a slight problem. It didn't work perfectly, though it worked pretty well. The problem was a lot of developers didn't really understand that that's what that did. And that's kind of understandable if you look at, you know, exactly how doctype works. If you've never dug into it, the way that doctypes work is that they don't just say, does it exist, does it not exist, but there's a whole table of what all of the rules are. So if I look at, hey, if I'm asking for 3, so off is standards off. So all of these are in quirks mode. And on, those are all standards mode. And that's standards mode. And then there's these weird ones in the middle, which is like, well, it depends on whether or not you put a URL in. So there's a whole nother series of logic. Do you have a doc type? Yes. Oh, well, which one is it? And that will determine whether or not you get standards mode. The number of developers that I've encountered in this world who understand really what a doc type does in terms of standards or quirks, I can still count on two hands. Not because they're dumb, but because most people don't handwrite HTML. So why would they know that? Their tool either jacks it in or it doesn't. And that's actually one of the things in the green ones highlighted that we notice is that there is some tool out there somewhere that generates HTML4 transitional code but doesn't include the URL, so it has a doc type and it reliably and consistently and in a lot of enterprises will still drop you into quirks mode. So we had these two different ways of laying out, and we had put all the responsibility in the hands of a developer, and the developers didn't always understand it because it was legitimately complex, not because they weren't smart, but because it was sort of a hard thing. But nonetheless, it did a pretty good job of resolving it. So we had two, and we called them standards and quirks. We moved to IE7. We said, oh, yep, great. If you want standards, we'll make your standards even more standardy, awesome, and quirks will leave the same. Moving to IE8, we did a complete rewrite. We, Microsoft, did a complete rewrite of our HTML4 support, do-over, revisit it all, and we said, wow, by making it more standards compliant by definition means different. Different by definition means you could break something. So we said, let's not break anything. We have this construct of here's two different things. Let's add a third. So then we had three different document modes you could potentially have. And we hid it behind a binary switch. If you've heard of compatibility view, what does this thing do? It says, well, if you are not in compat view, the standards you'll get is 8 standards. If you are in compat view, the standards you'll get is 7 standards. And quirks will always be IE5 simulation. So far, so good. It kind of handles a binary switch. So we went to IE9 and said, now we're transitioning. So 8 is your HTML4 emulation. 9, well, that's going to start off with HTML5. Well, here's the problem. HTML5 wasn't done. It got to recommendation status, just the HTML5 spec itself, and there's a lot of surrounding specs that are interesting. That got to recommendation status in November of last year, well after we'd released IE9 or even IE10 or 11. So we left the HTML4, we added an HTML5, we added another, and not shown here, there is yet another document mode that your web page could potentially be rendered in. And that document mode is what we call interoperable quirks, or interop quirks. I don't know that we've actually given it a public branding, but that's what we refer to it internally, which basically responds to one kind of important problem. If we have a quirks mode that's different from the quirks mode that's used by every other browser, then the web will behave differently on our browser than it does in everyone else's, if you don't have a doc type or a standards doc type. So we said, that's no good. But we also couldn't dump the IE5 emulation because a lot of people use that, so we kept both. So there's technically two quirks modes now, one that behaves a lot like everybody else's quirks and one that behaves a lot like IE5. And that matters because when we look at even the top 1,000 most visited sites on the web, 12% of them run in quirks mode. So it's not a tiny problem. What's even more scary to me, which is why we want to start the conversation of modernization here today, is that 70% of enterprise web applications worldwide, 70% use IE5 quirks. They are writing to a 1999 implementation of web standards. That's kind of like bringing a horse and buggy to a NASCAR race or to a Formula One race. You just can't keep up. So how do we address that? So that's what we did for backwards compatibility. We brought in all these things, and there are now 7 different ways you could potentially behave. Super powerful. Really powerful and really effective. We said, when we go in to fix stuff, we can fix most everything. And we looked at all of the cases and escalations that we brought in, and I run a global team that deals with those escalations, and there only was a handful that we weren't able to resolve. So we said, here's a great baseline technology, but there's really only one way that you can apply it. the developer could add an XUA-compatible meta tag to their code. Right, and we'll go ahead and take a look here. I wrote an article on this kind of talking about it. This is well before we had any other options. And I said, hey, here's all the different rendering engines that we've had and how you can choose from them and some examples of, you know, kind of what they look like and, you know, when things go wrong, right? There's typically one of two reasons when this didn't work. Number one, you had a syntax error. We saw this a lot. I actually subsequently found out why we saw a lot of these. Because we posted the syntax error in MSDN and people copied and pasted it, so go us, that was awesome. So we fixed that, and hopefully people are copying and pasting the right stuff now. This is the old one, do not do this way, this is bad, so don't ignore that. There's no I at the beginning, just call it 8 or whatever you want. Or it comes too late, because when we start rendering to the page or running a script, we have to have some document, we gotta plug it into something. So if you put a script first and then you put your meta tag later, we'll like see output now an error message, hey, you're trying to set it, but you're too late, you can't do that. So the developer could do this. They had total control here, 7 different things. Pick your poison, you can have whatever you want. Remember the doc type and how lack of awareness of doc type was a problem? Well, this isn't browser agnostic. This is specific to IE, which, let's be honest, probably isn't most web developers' favorite thing to go and research, if we're honest with ourselves. So the number of websites that I've come across in the wild that actually put in XUA compatible is really small, really, really small. SharePoint does. SharePoint does, starting with SharePoint 2010 and continuing in SharePoint 2013. No other commercial software have I run across. I've run into one public website that does, and that's it. So super powerful, but the people who have the knobs aren't interested in flipping them. So all right, so let's hopefully get the defaults right. So we looked at this concept, right? We can keep a lot of apps working. It seems to be working really well, and we suddenly have a large body of customers who are very motivated to get onto modern versions of IE. So we said, how do we do that? How do we take this concept and make it easier for someone who's running an organization to drive this? And we said, aha, you know what we can do? We can package it up and make it easier. So we introduced in April of last year something that we called Enterprise Mode. And Enterprise Mode was designed 100% in mind with the person who is currently today running IE8. And the idea was this: whatever doc mode IE8 would have given you, if we give you the exact same one, chances are it'll carry on working. So we tried it, and we put it out there, and we said, and we're going to also look at ways that we can continue to enhance the functionality. But we were not interested in doing it as a science experiment and the ability for us to imagine all of the things that might exist. Instead, we wanted to do it to target the things that actually existed in the real world. So we built it in close partnership with folks who were creating applications and running organizations and testing it. So the initial foray into Enterprise Mode had 10 customers using it day in and day out and reporting back anything that didn't work so that we could add that functionality into Enterprise Mode. Things like we were breaking ActiveX controls. And we were doing it with a bit of functionality that turns out to be, you know, useful in some situations, but doesn't work well with controls. That is, when you go to a web page and there is a reasonably high probability that you're going to follow a link on that page, for example, if there is a next button on the page, the likelihood you're going to click it turns out to be relatively high. We can prefetch it. Gather the page and have it ready to go. So when you click next, you don't have to wait for the web latency. You don't have to wait for the network. You can just immediately flip over to it. And we would flip over to it. The new architecture that we put into the browser starting in IE8 has a different content process hosting the content of the page. So we could literally swap out the process and display it instantaneously, already pre-rendered, really, really fast. Great user experience. But if you're in ActiveX control, you're sitting on a page, and all of a sudden the process you're in disappears, and a brand new one appears underneath you, and you're like, what the heck is going on? Then you might break. So we turned it off. when you're in enterprise mode to increase that compatibility, because we found actual apps that did that. We found actual applications that were using things like CSS expressions, which are not web standards, but were important, and we brought that functionality back. And we looked for other ways, and we took feedback, we took cases. If you have Premier support, how many of you have Premier support and have opened up any cases? Right? So a handful of folks, we were taking them non-decrement. It's a feature opportunity for us to make it better. We will not charge you case hours. Just tell us when it doesn't work so we can figure out if we can make it work to evolve it. So we took doc modes, we made them better, we packaged them up, and it was great for anyone who was going to IE8. And then, as we kept thinking, what do we need to do? Turns out there's customers who were already on 9 or 10 where that didn't work, because going back to 8 was often too far backwards. So we said, oh, how do we address it for those? And rather than saying, well, make your 9 mode, make a 10 mode, we actually went and introduced something. And I'll go ahead and hit the drop down here. The tool I'm using to introduce it is the Enterprise Mode Site List Manager. So this is where I can go in and edit how I'm going to address web pages. And this is what we used to have. And we're going to cover all, make sure we kind of tie this whole thing off and everyone understands these configurations. IE8 Enterprise Mode is what we used to just call Enterprise Mode, which used to be on or off. Now it's just one of many. And we say, well, we're going to give you opportunity to access all of the different documents, the exact same powers the web developer would have. So now I can click them all on. And so if I'm already on IE9 and the web page is running in IE9 document mode, then I can dial back to that. Very quick, very easy, and set it that way. Incidentally, for anyone who is familiar with XUA compatible let you pick a specific document mode. These are equivalent to what we would have called in XUA compatible the emulate tags. If you're a standards web page because of your doc type, then you'll get 9 standards. If you're quirks, you get 5 quirks. On 10, standards will be 10 standards, quirks will be interop quirks, the same way that IE10 did it. So it allows you to dial into the different document modes, but to still try and keep it as simple as possible. So now we reached a new audience. We introduced that in November of last year. We then moved forward and said, yeah, there's actually one interesting scenario we started to hear from a lot of customers. As we think through document modes and configurations, a lot of people were telling us, hey, I like the manageability. If I look at what I'm able to do here, right, here's a web page, but I can go in and configure not only the page itself, but also subpaths within that page. And that was historically a big problem. So if we look at what we had in our arsenal before in our group policies, the compatibility view group policies would only allow me to go in and add a top-level domain name. And that's it. So an example of where that fell down for us, we at Microsoft, before we made the transition over to Office 365, were still hosting a legacy SharePoint 2007 web farm for collaboration with our customers. Didn't want to upgrade it because we knew we were going to throw it away and move directly to Office 365, so we said we're just going to leave that for now while we do the transition. SharePoint 2007 runs everything in IE5 quirks mode. That's how it achieves its compatibility, quirks for everything. Problem is, quirks changed starting in IE10. IE10 became interop quirks if you're in the internet zone. So different definition all of a sudden. So, and interop quirks, turns out, didn't really work with SharePoint 2007. It was not a happy thing. Things would break. So we said, oh, how do you fix it? Well, you could add it, but the only way to do it would be to put in all of Microsoft.com, which means you're going to clobber everything. And now you're going to force everything back into compat view, which breaks all of our modern HTML5 sites. It wasn't granular enough. So we got that feedback and said, all right, well, this new manageable, go to the path level, that's super awesome. I'd like to do this everywhere. Can I please use it to replace my group policies? And so we had to figure out how we could accommodate that. So that's why we added some additional functionality as well. So let's go into what that is, kind of close this off and tie it. So remember when I talked about emulate IE7 is what that's the equivalent of. Emulate IE7 or IE7 doc mode in an enterprise mode site list is 100% equivalent to compatibility view. Is there a question? How do you get to this configuration? This is a tool called the Enterprise Mode Site List Manager, which is a free download, and about to be updated, so I would wait until probably next week to grab it. And we'll talk about what's coming. But you can grab it now. I mean, it's free. You can download as many times as you want to. But we do have an update coming. That is exactly the same as Compat View, and this new Enterprise Mode is exactly the same as Enterprise Mode plus Compat View. Because that was confusing a lot of people. I've got Enterprise Mode and I've got Compat View, and they thought Enterprise Mode replaced Compat View. And it doesn't, because Enterprise Mode is behave like IE8 did. Well, IE8 had Compat View. So if we took Compat View away, then suddenly we can't actually do a good emulation of IE8. So we've got both, and this is how I can flip the knob and get rid of the group policies if I so choose. So we built all of this up and put this configuration. What's coming, and what I alluded to when I said, you know, look for announcements coming soon, is that we also have shipped, as part of the latest Windows 10 build, support for having port numbers, a super common request. And the new build that's coming out is going to go into details on how to do that and let you configure that within there. So for right now, you don't have that option in there. But what it does provide for you is all the different document modes, as well as, if I'm using Windows 10, should I open up IE to go to this web page? If it doesn't work in Edge, that lets it automatically pop open and navigate back into IE to get that working. So that's the foundation we laid. Here's a way that we can give people control over all of the web applications that they're responsible for. So a couple of FAQs about this. What are people doing when they find this? You know, we don't build it to handle all hypotheticals you can come up with. There are web pages you can invent that Enterprise Mode won't fix. And we're never going to put them unless we spot them in the wild. We don't care about hypotheticals. We really care about being very practical. This is a tactical solution. Let's fix the stuff that's actually broken and invest in that, rather than trying to dream up the things that might potentially be broken. And what we've found is that more than half of customers that we work with are able to fix everything that's broken using some configuration of the Enterprise Mode site list. And I differentiate that from Enterprise Mode by itself, because the site list has doc modes and compat view and all these other illusions. But one of these settings works for everything broken for more than half of our customers, which is remarkable. I've been doing app compat since 2006, and there's nothing I've seen that is that effective in remediating and getting things to working again, particularly when there's so few options to choose from. So really, really good. For those where it doesn't fix everything, the largest number of applications we've seen broken and confirmed that number has been 4. And these are massive multinational organizations where the only things that don't fix is a small handful of apps. And some of them are documented. I've got one that is really pretty common, honestly, which is there's a couple of versions of Crystal Reports and a couple bits of functionality that don't work correctly, or Business Objects, sorry. I'm getting them confused, but I think they're all consolidated. It's under SAP, but it's Business Object, a couple of old versions, and a couple of bits of functionality that don't work correctly. And we can't go back and fix it, believe me, we would. The problem is the code that's breaking. The code that's breaking is actually workaround code. So what had happened in this particular situation is that there was a bug in actual IE8. And the bug was blocking their application's functionality. So they wrote a workaround. Now, the workaround code, it turns out, breaks if you don't have the bug. And because of the architecture of the browser where the bug happened to be located, we couldn't factor the bug in only when in enterprise mode. So we had now a choice that was a really tough choice. We can put the bug back into the browser and break everything else that hated that bug, or leave the bug out and break business objects. Because we have no way of saying only put the bug in if your business object's rendering it. We couldn't isolate that and target it. So we kept the bug out, and that ends up breaking. And I've seen some, and I'll be posting on my blog some workaround code that I've seen. I've not verified it, but I figure I at least put the pointer in there to show what's happening. There are a handful of things like that that we've seen be potentially an issue. But in terms of the magnitude of the problem, really, really small, very, very effective. What this means in terms of a strategy is that now I have a way that you can probably get all of my stuff working. And that's awesome. That's exactly where I want to start. Because when you think about the best way to modernize the web estate within any organization, the way that I recommend is to modernize the browser first and the content second. And the reason why I say that is that I've seen a lot of organizations do the opposite. You know what, as part of getting to, you know, the most modern version of this thing, we're going to make absolutely everything work on that platform first, and then we'll deploy it everywhere. So if you're a dev team and you own a bunch of applications, you'll have to fix everything, get it working on the new browser natively. We're going to turn all the helper functions off, and then we'll migrate. And the consequence of that that we've seen, the unintended consequence, is that because you are doing those changes while there's an older browser being used day to day, you have to make least common denominator choices. You can only write code that works on both your old browser and your new one. You can't do new cool things that only a modern browser can do. You're held back. And if you're on IE8, you're constrained by what IE8's capable of doing, which is HTML4. You don't get HTML5. And therefore, you're spending a lot of money but not getting as much bang for your buck. Instead, you want to be able to put the browser out first and then modernize the content. And a consequence, a side effect of that, is that now, by having this enterprise mode site list, and by the way, we very deliberately do not incorporate into that the ability to just put a wildcard and say, do my entire estate, everything in my organization, put it all in enterprise mode. My recommendation for how to configure that is I should be putting in an entry for every atomic unit of application upgrade. There's an app team that owns it and will ship. That path should have an entry. And that way I can manage it down, because that's the overall goal. Take whatever this list is and manage it down, reduce it until eventually it goes away. And when it goes away, all of my stuff is modern. I have no more dependencies on that. Now, from a, you know, what do you hear from marketing versus what do you hear in the real world point of view? I'm not in marketing, I'm a nerd. I try to not be self-delusional. Marketing will say, oh, that lets you get to Edge, and Edge is great. And Edge is good. We'll talk about Edge, and we'll talk about all the things. I'm not here to do a marketing pitch for it, though. What I hear is much more like this, right? The more I can eliminate my dependencies on legacy versions of IE, the more devices I can use my content on. If I have a hard dependency on an IE8 document mode, that means I today am only going to be able to use that site on my Windows desktop or tablet device. Can't even use it on the phone, because the phone doesn't ship with IE. Can't use it on my iPad, that doesn't have IE. Can't use it on my Android tablet, that doesn't use IE. Can't use it on my Chromebook, that doesn't have IE. Can't use it anywhere else. Only on a Windows device. And that eliminates a lot of really interesting scenarios. And that's why I think that matters. You know, I think we've got a great story with our browser stack, but I think there's other devices, too, that deserve the same great story. And we want to try to manage that number down. It's my to-do list. Here are all of the things that I need to go after and do. Right, so here's all the sites, and this is an example of what I've been collecting off of my machines and all the places that I've navigated to. You know, here it is, just as a site list fix that's a lot shorter and easier to parse. But that's what I want to try and manage down, is just one by one, eliminate these and check these and pull them off of having to have this dependency on compatibility view. Now, when we then look at some of the other ancillary things to do, right, getting this down and suing, let's talk about some of the other FAQs. how many sites can be on there? If I'm going to do it atomically and do one per, how big can my list go? I've seen it as high as 40,000 entries. 40,000 is kind of a lot, but without any really negative performance impact. It takes longer to build, but you can certainly scale it up to be as high as you want to. What we also wanted to do is to try and simplify that process to make it so that you didn't manually have to add all of that. So in addition to tooling, we introduced in November of last year another toolkit that we called the Enterprise Site Discovery Toolkit. Inventory for the web. How can you find the things that are out there? And there are a couple of different ways that it's implemented. One of them is through WMI. So if I look here and say, all right, well, show me all of the information that I get in terms of sites that I've gone to, there's a WMI endpoint. This is sitting off of my machine, pulling all the stuff that I gather to off of there. This is shipped as part of IE, all the way back to IE8. If you've run your Windows updates, then you have it. If you've not run your Windows updates, why aren't you running your Windows updates? You should have them. But this is part of the browser. Turning it on simply requires running a PowerShell script if you want WMI, because the PowerShell script sets up all the WMI classes that you need. We are looking at whether we should make that part of the installer, right? Configuring that as part of IE. We haven't yet, because there's a lot of privacy concerns around site discovery. So if you want WMI, you run a PowerShell script that turns it on. If you don't want WMI, you have another option. You also have the option to put it on XML output. And what the XML output will do is just put it into XML, and then I can collect it there and look at it that way. So no WMI, I don't have to have a WMI reader, I can just grab the raw XML, and as a bonus, that XML can be imported. So if I go into the site list manager, I can actually go in and open import, and I will do it directly from Where am I? Here I am. This is what's running on mine. Oh, you want Emmy? I don't want Emmy. I want to bulk add from file. Hit the wrong option. Sorry about that. Bulk add from file, I'm going to go in and import from what I've been collecting off of this device. And all I've done is just say, you know what, collect everything that I'm doing. And it's going to go ahead and suck them all in. It's going to validate the URLs. It's going to make sure that it's actually someplace that's live and configurable. And bring them all in one shot. So it gives me an easy way to collect that. So now I can go and import that. Oh, that's awesome. And crash the site list manager. That's fantastic. Let me open a shorter one then. Just because waiting for that. Actually, I wonder if I can just cancel the validation. Cancel the validation. Oh, I canceled the whole thing. That's so not awesome. I'm just going to grab a small one just so that we can carry this forward, and then I will debug that later. What I normally like to say is that I have no such thing as a failed demo. I can only have unplanned debugging demos, but our intent here is to go through and do a whole bunch of debugging. Oh, there's a redirect. But I can just go in and import all of them, suck them all in quickly and easily to bring that in. So that's one advantage of doing XML. The other advantage is I can start to look at specific scenarios. So one of the scenarios that I look at is, hey, if I'm interested in retiring CompatView, I can use Site Discovery to find all the sites that I'm going to. Site Discovery gathers the document mode that you're using. With that document mode, I can look at them and say, show me all of the sites that I have that are using 5 or 7. Because if they're 5 or 7, they're using CompatView. And here they are. And now I can target those. Now I have another list that's actionable. You can't change what you can't measure. So now with this combination of tool sets, the Enterprise Mode Site List, Enterprise Site Discovery, I can start to work the complete scenario. I'd like to remove the group policy that puts everything into CompatView. Why do I want to remove that? Because while that group policy is enabled, if I have a developer create a brand new site, that brand new site, unless they put in XUA compatible, will end up living in CompatView, and you'll be developing for IE7. Question? What's that?
Every site that I've had to create
Yeah, so the comment from the audience, for anyone listening to the recording, is we had that problem in our organization, and it's really common. We have the defaults, and every time we make a new application, it inherits the default, and I've got to go in and put myself in as an exception. It's great to not be an exception and behave that way. The thing that's really important about it when I'm handling it from an enterprise mode site list perspective is the enterprise mode site list has the highest priority of anything. There's lots of different things that can switch doc mode. The enterprise mode site list overrules them all. So, if I put the enterprise mode site list for my entire organization, company.com.au, and everything gets it, the developer cannot overrule that like they could with CompatView, which means you will not be able to make a modern website, period. Non-negotiable, unless you get an exception filed onto the path, right? Because you can put in an exception if you look here at how this is configured, right? This says default for the home page, but the exception there. I could also, you know, reverse it here and say, you know what, default in IE8, and now suddenly I can say, oh, this path gets excluded, but I have to explicitly configure it. The developer can't do it. So if I throw my whole domain, people are going to still be making legacy content and growing the size of the problem. So that's what we're hoping to do, is retire, to shrink the size of the problem and make it easier. So a couple of other side comments about the technologies in play, because it's super important whether you're a developer or an admin that you understand the tools, you have a good sense of how well they should or shouldn't work, right? And when they're not working, we're always very curious. I've had two customers that escalated up and said, I've got 60 things that don't work, and you said 3 is the highest. It's now 4, but at the time it was 3. And I went out to visit them, and it turns out that, you know, it wasn't our stuff at all. Like one example, they had updated their Java at the same time, and Java 1.7 update 51 changes the rules on digital signatures. They had everything unsigned. They had all these warning things. They were Java alerts. It had nothing to do with the browser, but they got lumped in together. And so they were not an exception to the rule. I've got another one right now. I'm going to go visit them and figure out what's going on. If you find yourself outside of the norm, we're curious to hear what that is so we can go in and figure out how to make that better. A couple of other things that we've seen people learning. We added the ability to go into the tools menu and turn on enterprise mode here. And zoom it doesn't work when that's selected, which is very weird. All right, well, you can't see it very well. Sorry, I'm not zoomed in. But enterprise mode is a tools option. We're not actually really happy with how that turned out, right? Number one, a lot of organizations turn that on for end users. Hey, just go and click this on, and that fixes it. It's not a great end user feature, and here's why. This gets stored someplace that we clear when you clear your cache. So if you're testing, it makes it easy to reset. If you're an end user that wanted that site to stay fixed, we're re-breaking it for you every time you clear your cache. Kind of not awesome. The other thing that happens is when you have composite web pages that have multiple iframes pulling content from different places, it sets the enterprise mode config for the main page, the host, but not for all of the children, which is potentially different from what your site list would do. So what I normally recommend is to build out a local site list and add the XML directly there. So I could save my site list that I'm creating on that device for testing, right, if I'm in charge of the remediation team. Now, you may potentially run into a conflict. We do at Microsoft because we have an enterprise mode site list at Microsoft. Believe it or not, we had some users that were tied to IE8. Which meant we couldn't upgrade them off of Windows 7, which is strategically a problem for us. So we fixed it with an enterprise mode site list ourselves, which means now I've got group policy pushing that down to me. So I've got to overwrite it. So I wrote myself a PowerShell script to go ahead and overwrite what was pushed down to me via group policy. And of course, this will last until the next time group policy applies. And then I forced an immediate refresh, right? So this refresh version, if I'm editing it, I go and whack this registry key, and it will take away the current version and force a reload of the new site list to immediately bring in those changes. So a couple of things that we've learned as people have begun to go through and implement all of these different changes. In terms of deployment, how are we seeing people put it out there successfully? We see a couple of different options for deploying it. The group policy just sets a reg key saying, here's where to go get your site list. And you have a choice of using the file protocol or using the HTTP protocol. I recommend anywhere you can using HTTP, particularly if your site list gets big. Because if your site list gets relatively big, what happens, and if we look at a site list here, whoops, that was weird. Let's zoom in here. We determine whether or not to grab a new one by the version number. So this one says version equals 3. If we grab a new site list and there's a different version number, we'll replace it. Doesn't matter if it's higher or lower, it just has to be different. It lets you roll back easily, roll forward, do whichever. If you were on the file protocol, we download the whole file and look at the version in the XML. If you use the HTTP protocol, we make an HTTP request, and if the response is 302 not modified, then we say, yep, it hasn't changed, so we don't download it. So now you just have the header-only conversation. Is there a new one? Nope. And it's very fast and very efficient. If you have a large list, you're downloading the entire file. There's a lot more potential for network bandwidth utilization. So a little tip. So that's what we've been building around how do we help people get their applications up and working as quickly and as easily as we can. And it's been really successful. The next step that we hope people will take is to think about how they can get the configuration not dependent on do the following 19 things to the configuration of your browser to get it working again. And in fact, if we look at what the potential risk is for having all these different possible permutations, to illustrate, I kind of put a little animation, and up on the screen, cycling past are all of the different possible permutations that the IE group policies alone can be configured in. And it rolls on and on and on because there are, at this point, nearly 1,600 different configuration options that you can choose to make IE behave differently. And it's an incredibly complex system. And if you look at the numbers scrolling by, it's a little terrifying. By way of comparison, this is the number of molecules in the observable universe. Doesn't even fill up one screen. Turns out, we don't have as many test cases as we have permutations. Not even close. In fact, it also turns out that if we were to do one test case every nanosecond, from the beginning of time until now, not enough time has passed for us to have done even one pass. So the reality is, if you're going through and tweaking all of the different options, we probably have no clue what's going to happen because you are the only people on the planet who've ever seen that configuration before. No idea what's going to happen. Right? And one rule I like to point out, if you've never read this article, my friend Aaron wrote this a while back, and it just keeps applying over and over and over again. If you're the sort of person where the IT administration, when the new product comes out and the group policies are released, if you've ever seen the movie The Jerk starring Steve Martin, when he's like, oh, the new phone books are here, the new phone books are here, they behave very similar. Oh, the new group policies are here, new group policies. Let's go through and read them all and figure out what the best option is. The side effects of them are often not well known. And now you have a unique configuration that's very special to you. And I love some of the descriptions because I saw so many customers who end up like this, right? The apps I buy don't work until I put in some customization. Ramp-up time takes longer because I have to teach people how things work here. Just their computer knowledge alone doesn't do it anymore. If this guy gets hit by a truck, we're probably just going to go out of business, right? This is a challenge that we're starting to address. If you look at what we've been doing with Microsoft Edge, it has not been, let's get as many policies as we can. Our focus has much more been on, let's give you a configuration scenario for a complete scenario as best we can to give you the control you need to meet your specific business or regulatory or personal requirements, but to not give you more because this complexity is actively hurting people's agility. So part of the modernization process is, how do you get to a default config? And there are really two configuration options that I think you should focus on if you're going to have one. One of them is the configuration that it ships at, because that's what most of your end users are going to get. It's really secure by default. In fact, a lot of custom secure configurations were a secured IE6 configuration that kind of got carried forward, which it turns out is actually not that secure compared to our defaults today. So the default configuration is a great choice. And if you have a particular need for a high security configuration, I'm using a tool now called the Security Compliance Manager. It's a free tool that we ship content that goes and gives you guidance on how you could configure it. And the guidance we provide is specifically what we develop in terms of a security baseline that gets given to government organizations. So it's developed in conjunction with federal governments in a number of different countries to meet those specific high security requirements. And we see this being adopted externally because it's all published, it's all public. Here's something that's known and tested and lots of people use. This is deployed to millions and millions of seats around the world. And it will explain the setting, it will explain what happens if you turn it off, what's the threat, what's the vulnerability, what's the impact, to really help to understand if I can't turn that off for security reasons, what are the ramifications. So we start, right, let's get to a modern browser, use the tools to help us, let's get to a standard config, use the tools to give me that config, and the next question is, how do I update content? Right, so updating content really comes down to, you know, helping to figure out where I have legacy considerations, right? So here I have content, content that was developed for Quarks mode, I'd have to relay out this page. Right, so I have one quick and easy fix, which is I could swap out the document mode, and I can do that very easily from the F12 tools. Right, and once, don't close it, it'll just go back away. Five quirks, right, and now I have it behaving correctly, but I don't want to just depend on IE5 quirks forever. I want to go out and relay out the page so that it works correctly in a modern browser using modern constructs. Here's an example, and this is an actual site. It's on the public internet. I'm always amused by this one because this one tells me, I'm really sorry, we don't currently support, but we're working on it, and we're going to support it very soon. I've been demoing this site since 2009, so I think their definition of very soon and mine might be different. I don't actually think that they're going to do anything here. Then they suggest, well, why don't you try using a good browser? And here's a list. The interesting thing here is that this is the easiest thing to modernize. When we look at what they're doing, I can go in and poke around. I'll go into the debugger tab. And I'm going to look for... currently do not support. And we can, okay, so here's what I'm doing. Here's a paragraph. And this is all part of, something called the IE container. It has its own special name. So I can start digging through and say, all right, if I wanted to modernize this, IE container... and look for all instances there. All right, I'm finding it. And, here's interesting. And here's the code that it's actually doing. The single most common challenge we run into when it comes to applications not working correctly on IE or Edge today is it's checking to see what version of the browser it is. In fact, if you look at what the user agent string we're using for Edge, it's almost hilarious at this point because it will just say we're everything, right? It's kind of like, you know, if you ask someone like, hey, what's your name? Well, what do you want it to be? That kind of response. This is actually not doing that. This blew me away. This is doing what we tell everybody to do. Check for features. It's checking to see whether the bird element exists. What's the bird element? An HTML5 canvas element. Well, why wouldn't it exist? We support canvas on Edge, on IE, starting in IE9, everything should be good, right? Well, one minor problem. This is the other example of someone that actually put in an XUA compatible. And here's what they did. I would like you to behave like IE7, a browser that does not do HTML5. Then I'm going to try and do some HTML5 stuff and get really grumpy when you can't do it. Basically, we're broken because they asked us to be broken. Now, I don't think they were quite that stupid, because it does potentially limit their market share. So here's what I'm going to guess happened. Right? That this copyright date's probably out of date. But 2009, plausible. They were writing an HTML5 application. They tested it on IE8. Saw it didn't work. Looked up and said, how do I make IE8 be more compatible? Saw a switch. Said, oh, this should make it more compatible. Still didn't work. Didn't remove it. And so it persists to this day. So the fix here is just to stop telling it to be an old browser. And while not the world's fastest website, it actually works just fine. So this modernization is very easy. Stop putting the code in that breaks it. So it's this evolution, right? We think about this every time. Here I'd lay out the page. Here the page already works, so I'm going through and making sure that I leverage my knowledge of document modes to get things back into a correctly working state. Here's another example. This is the version that I was checking about. This is an application that is checking to see, oh, well, what's the version? Right, it's a public website, and I just randomly look. I actually have no idea whose site this is. I just plucked it at random, and I know that this particular app breaks basically everywhere. It's checking to see what version of the script engine you have. So how could I fix that? Enterprise mode will lie about the version of the script engine. So it passes the test, and then it's going to try and install some ActiveX controls. At this point, my confidence in the ability of these people to write great code is a little bit shaken, so I'm going to go ahead and not install their controls. But that's one fix. How would I fix that in the code? Let me see, I don't have the debugger tab, it'll be easier. Turns out the word sufficient is fairly unique and easy to find. Here's the code. So another relatively straightforward fix, right? And we look at what the initial modernization, not really taking advantage of it, but just getting it baseline working, is often really straightforward. This is a simple logical error. They wanted to make sure that you're using at least version 5.5 of the script engine, which means they probably wrote it a while ago. And they're like, oh, we don't work in 5.4 or earlier, so let's just put in a check. Version checks are nearly always a bad idea. I have computed that the cost of version checks to the world at this point is at least $1 billion in wasted productivity in going back and fixing them, at least. Now, I don't think they've generated at least $1 billion worth of value. So if you can avoid them, you really should, because you're probably going to do it wrong. This is a very well-intentioned one. It worked great on everything that existed at the time. What version of the JavaScript engine did we introduce in IE9? 9.0. Is 9 greater than or equal to 5? Yes. Is 0 greater than or equal to 5? No, it fails, and we duck out here. It's just a badly written logical check. Now, how would you write that if you were fixing the code? Go ahead and close this. I don't need that. And let's make a new. All right, so here's the bad broken code. How would you write it correctly? Right? It's actually not a trivial question. One of the interesting things, and I ask this a lot, I'm not going to put anyone on the spot here, but if I'm doing a workshop, I'll ask people, and I thus far have had two people answer it correctly and come up with a different way to do it. One person actually converted it to a string and put in a period, and then did a full floating point decimal, and did a comparison against the decimal. If you wanted to write it logically without, consolidating the two of them. What we want to do is fail it. Major version is less than 5. Or, right, so that would be all the version 4 script engines, which probably don't exist. Or script engine major version equals 5. And script engine minor is less than 5. That will give me the correct logical check. That is way too small. Let's zoom in on that. Simple logical error. The other thing I could consider is, can I just get rid of that? Does that even help me anymore? Is there anyone that I care about that is using Windows 98 against my website? They may exist. I've seen some very strange things. I've actually seen government agencies in a country that will go unnamed that were using Windows Millennium Edition, ME, like the successor to 98 SE, in production a year ago. So someone's probably going to have it, right? But when they call you for support, you can hang up on them. You know, I'm sorry, I don't support Windows 98. You'll have to really update yourself for the first time in apparently 20 years. Right, but you can deny that. And more, right, if you can just get rid of the code, you end up better off, right, as we continue to go through and figure out how do we modernize. Write a good logical check, or don't write a logical check at all. Right? We keep thinking we have to. And I would suggest, let's think about whether or not we're actually driving business value in doing that. So take these actions and get the applications to the point where I'm able to modernize them, but getting them up to the current document mode so that if I have IE today, I'm running Windows 7, it tees me up nicely. The other thing I like to think about when I am going through and doing work on modernization is to think about not just getting locked in on IE11 now or on Edge now, but instead to think about how can I make sure that I just work everywhere that I might care about without having a ridiculously complex test matrix. So there's some things I'm going to explicitly support, but I also want to be mindful of building things that make sense. So another resource I'll point out is that we have, it's got a really long name now. I usually just use the URL, which is really fast, status.modern.ie, which redirects automatically to this one. But what we started to do is to track out the roadmap, which is for us, but also includes other people's content. So if I look at what I can do, I can say, you know what? All right, I'm going to care about Edge. It's kind of an Edge-first thing. You'll notice that, right? When we think about what is the strategy for Microsoft browsers going forward, IE11 is done. It is not getting enhanced. We are not adding new functionality to it. It is the end of the line, and Edge is where we're investing. So the Edge-centric, and I have asked, and hopefully we'll get to also have IE one of the options here. In the interim, I can still go in and say, you know what, I care about Chrome, because I have people with Android devices, and Safari, because I have people with iPads, and maybe I don't care about Opera or Firefox, but show me everything that is currently supported in these. And I want it also in Edge, I want it supported, or at least in preview, right? Or maybe all the way to supported, and show me all of those. And now I can look for all these different elements, right? Canvas, we introduced it in IE9. It's always been in Edge, and it's in every single browser out there. So this gives you the ability to go in and query and say, let's not build it on a standard that's going to lock me in. You know, I don't want to have something that is deprecated. Do we have any? Oh, zero. That's not planned. Well, here's one. All right, so here's one that's not planned, but it is implemented here. So I'd basically be saying, yep, I'm going to be choosing not to work in any Microsoft browser if I use that. It is an established standard, right? And certainly we can change our minds, and we do take feedback on what we should be building next. We can look at what's under consideration, everything here, but I can look at and really figure out exactly what the status is, so I'm building upon standards that are going to put me in a good spot. And then if I have a standard that's going to allow me to add value, I can make a smart decision, right? But it, to me, doesn't make sense to say, well, all of these things exist in this browser, and I like that browser, so therefore I'm going to do whatever things I want. But to be mindful, which standards am I using, and what is that going to do in terms of constraints? So we have this as a resource, which can be really easy. What's that? What's the website? So it's at dev.windows.com, and it's got this kind of long thing here, but how I like to get there is just, and I'll zoom in before I go here. Whoa, that's way too close. Status.modern.ie. We'll redirect there onto the Edge site. It was kind of convenient that Ireland had an IE suffix when we had IE. Now that it's Edge, there's no country that we know of that has a .edge as their country code. But we sort of leveraged that. And I still remember those, so it's a lot of habit is going there. And it's really fast and easy to type. But it gives you that level of resource. And I love the ability to do that, because now I can make smart, informed decisions. I'm going to take this standard, it's under consideration, and let me go nudge it. So if I have something that's under consideration, show me it's under consideration, and like, oh, yeah, beacon, maybe I really want to use that. I can add a vote. And click on the link right there and say, I would like to vote for it and explain why. So here we can even see where it is. It's on the Edge backlog with a priority of high. And you can track the status changes here. Dev.modern.ie, WAC platform, WAC status, WAC beacon. To try and really communicate based upon those votes. And if I wanted to nudge it, then I could add my vote and increment it by one. And inform that so we can make sure that we're doing the right stuff. So I've got build out my standards. The other thing that we provide access to VMs. So while you have to support a lot of other ones, I can say, you know what, I'm running on my Mac, so I'm going to use, and I also want to grab IE6. Wow, maybe hopefully not that. But maybe I've got, you know, some Win7s running IE8. And I want to put it onto, I don't know, Parallels. I grab a VM that will work for that to let me test it while I still have the transition, one of the tools that we offer. But what's also useful is SiteScan. And SiteScan, I mean, when we talk about how do we assess compatibility, how we look at it, everyone is always looking for the silver bullet that says, find me all the bugs on my site, find me everything that needs to be updated, and give me a report. That sort of static analysis has not worked well on the web. We actually see an accuracy rate of about 2% in the very best stuff out there. Not because the developers are bad, but because the problem is a hard one. If you shift something one pixel to the left, is it broken? I don't know. That depends. If I do it consecutively 70 different times, I may slide a button behind a picture and make it unclickable, and that's broken. If I'm showing you the plans for how to build a bridge, that pixel could be the difference between structurally sound and it collapses into the river. If it's a typical form-based website, nobody may ever notice that one pixel difference, right? And there's all kinds of things like that where we cannot infer the intent. So what we try to do here is find the big stuff. So if I look at, let me pick, I can't do that one because it's local. I'm going to pick this download site. Or does anyone want to see what their company is doing? Does anyone want to victimize their company website? What's that? How do I spell it? Kmart, let me actually find what that is. Kmart Australia. Yep, I want to copy and paste so I don't get it wrong. It's really boring to watch me type badly. So let me go quickly there. And I'll go through and scan it. And one of the things that I have found the most valuable is that the number one challenge I see with modernizing when I work with customers who are trying to move forward is legacy frameworks. It is so darn easy to say, jQuery, that's my framework. It's awesome. I'm going to use it everywhere. I'm going to go grab it. And I grab my jQuery, And then I forget that that's middleware that needs to be serviced. And I leave that .js file on my website between now and the end of time because it doesn't feel like middleware to me. It doesn't get upgraded. And they get enhanced. They add browser support. I have no idea what we're doing here. Oh, the frameworks and libraries are in great shape here. So that's fantastic. And the only thing we're really seeing is, yep, we're doing some browser detection. We spotted some code. It'd be great not to do that. And there's some prefix CSS that may be for a good reason. So, you know, I may not respond to all of this, but it gives me that information, right? And this is probably the single most used functionality I found, is to be able to quickly sniff out where have you not kept your jQuery's up to date. Where have you not kept your modernizers up to date? Where have you not kept your, insert your favorite framework here? It looks at how to make it cross-browser, whether you're using all these input elements, whether you support pre-render, pre-fetch, whether you give clues. And there's a couple of things for Windows. Obviously, we're a company that makes Windows, so we're like, yeah, it'd be kind of cool if you did this. It's certainly not going to hurt you on other platforms, but it makes your experience on Windows better to do things like supporting tiles, notifications, and so forth. But it gives you the ability to do a quick scan and spot some of the most frequent issues that we see with folks who are trying to go through and do modernizing, get things up to date, and move forward. So to kind of recap the journey we've gone on, right? We started all the way back in the 90s with sites that used to look like this, and we said, let's figure out how do we get rid of the old browser first? That's the most important thing. We leverage enterprise mode and site discovery to figure out what's out there. Then, all right, now we're here. Well, what have we done to kind of give ourselves a custom config, and can we get out from underneath that? Okay, so now we're back into more standard-looking thing. Now let's take this list. Let's take all of the sites that we've pushed back down into a legacy document mode, and let's move them forward. Let's gradually whittle down that list until we get to zero. And when we get to zero, we finally live in a world where we are not bound to our IE, that we have freedom of browser, freedom of device, and we're able to increase our reach, our impact, and our influence. And when you do that, awesomeness begins. Thank you very much.